Good afternoon. This is Yannikin Smucker. I'm a co-editor of the Oral History Review, and we have another edition of OHR Conversations. And I'm so delighted to welcome here today Lina, also professionally known as Na Li, as you might be familiar with Chinese naming conventions. And she's stateside in California currently, was waylaid here doing some research in the United States. And I'm really happy that we could find only a 3-hour time difference to meet and talk about your recent article in the Oral History Review, History, Memory, and Identity, Oral History in China, which came out in issue 47.1. And I really found it quite fascinating, really wonderful contribution to our global field of oral history. And I think it's really important to see these pieces that are comparative. Geographically, we're all dealing with our own cultural, political, academic circumstances, and yet we're all doing work that intersects and relates to one another. So this is a really, I think, important contribution to the journal, and we were so happy to publish it. Na Li is a research fellow and professor at the Department of History in Zhejiang University, and she's also the editor of Public History, a National Journal of Public History, which is a Chinese publication, and international consulting editor for The Public Historian here in the United States. She serves on the board of directors for the National Council of Public History, and in addition has a book manuscript in the works, which I'm really happy, excited to hear about, Seeing History, Public History in China, in addition to a very long list of other publications. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me.
I want to start off, and your article does such a great job of giving us this background, and I definitely encourage any listeners to check it out. But can you summarize for us the impact that this very, it's exploding, this practice of oral history in China? What is the impact it's having on China and its citizens?
Well, as I have pointed out in the article, oral history as a historic source and data, traditional literature is nothing new in China. It's played a irreplaceable role in sustaining culture and tradition. It has also impacted historic writing and dissemination in various capacities since ancient times, but it was really in the past 2 decades, especially in the last 10 years, we started to see that oral history become both a scholarly and a public form of historic engagement. So while the idea of public has transformed over time, we're not talking about mindless masses looking just for information or consuming information. We're talking about the groups of educated, thoughtful, and socially responsible citizens. So across China, we see a diverse group of professionals, including journalists and historians, curators, archivists, and librarians, filmmakers, work with the historic conscious public to produce oral history with cutting-edge media technologies. So oral history at all social scales goes public. So when it does go public, it becomes enormous popular and among the ordinary Chinese, so start to influence the historic consciousness of a cross-section of what we call uncelebrated Chinese. So here we have a really strong sense of ownership, especially if we focus on the cognitive, emotional, and performative aspects of oral history. You start to see that direct connection between the collective inner sense of being who we are and this micro level of how to present that in the public domain. So when the public aspects of oral history really engages people to rethink and sometimes even question the kind of history we have learned from classrooms. So you start to see this new awakening of historic consciousness that allow people to see and understand and to embrace history in their own way and at such a scale. So that's, I think, is what our history has sort of impacted the ordinary Chinese today at such a scale.
You talked a little bit about you have a very ancient tradition of oral narrative and oral stories being passed down in China. How do you sort of distinguish between oral history as the field and methodology today in the 21st century and oral tradition, oral literature? And you also use the phrase oral data in your article.
Well, that's a great question, but it breaks down to the question of oral what. We have been talking about oral history and literature and materials, testimony, evidence. So for each of the terms, we have a Chinese, distinctive Chinese characters, a terminology to describe it. So rather than here to engage in this sort of theoretical or abstract definitional debate, I would like to just contextualize some of the differences of those terms. So oral tradition is, as I said in the article, is a focus on the recollections of the past that extends beyond one's own lifetime. And oral literature is captured in the written form that passed down for generations. So for example, the China Memory Projects I discussed in the article is to recapture some of what was lost from the oral tradition. And also oral literature over the centuries is the projects that launched by the National Library of China. And it's based on their extensive collections of intangible heritage and culture and traditions of China. So the oral literature and oral tradition sort of try to compensate or try to supplement what their collections. Whereas oral data is a little different. It used just in a very scholarly sense that you try to collect information and look for factual information gleaned from the oral histories. So the major portion of the oral histories in China actually falls into this category. They're not often used as part of the broader historic studies or nor historiographies in a scholarly or methodological sense, even with the women's history or the professional industrial history that I discussed in the article. They usually, those kind of more oral data, seen as a kind of supplement written documents, and or we see it in another historic source. And oral evidence, we define it as a first-hand information recalled retrospectively and preserved on a system, it serves for some historic propositions. So here, oral evidence and oral data in China are both employed to support certain propositions. The difference lies in how much they actually use. So for a list of projects that is discussed in the article, we talk about state-sanctioned versions of history. You have the open door policy, anti-Japanese war, and Nanjing Massacre, or known in the West as the Rape of Nanking, and the Three Line Constructions, or those kind of projects, they have draw a lot of public attention with very little public input. But you use oral history to sort of like support the already reached consensus of official version of a history. At a spatial level, I see most of public oral history projects in China try to reintroduce memory into constructed public space. I discuss the museum exhibits and also how people use the oral tradition and literature and data and evidence and into a comprehensive and build that into a comprehensive and detailed history of China and its culture, which actually dovetails with the official narratives in a kind of a space. So here, I just want to point out, despite the long history we're using the oral history in China, either as a source or as a method, there actually was no established oral history programs, of course, at the college or university level till around 2010 in mainland China. This actually means that the majority of the individuals and organizations that took on oral history projects in the late 20th or early 21st century without any training. So that draws the criticisms that, the project lacks the, a methodological rigor, or that affects the quality of the oral history. And I have a different view. I feel if the criticism is certainly valid, but it's a problem actually with a simple solution. You just provide the quality oral history training. For me, I think it's a challenge. And with all those differences, the terms that you mentioned, is that the real challenge is beyond the methodological level. It's about how practitioners and the public alike interpret and evaluate oral history. Those kind of crafts and skills are not easily trained in a structured environment. So here we know that oral history is kind of a we call it conversational narrative. Mm. So you have a social and a psychological relationship embedded in the spoken words. And so if we interpret them superficially, if we're impatient with the deep thinking process, and if we just look for factual information, we miss the very purpose of doing oral history in the first place. And so that's, I think, with all the differences, you know, the terms, and I seriously question how much, you know, we're doing is actually oral history. Mm-hmm. And I ask that in a very genuine curiosity. They might really offend a lot of people as I ask, I'm asking that question in the article, and I'm asking that myself again here, is that, you know, when we talk about oral history, are we talking about data? Are we talking about the evidence? So that's something that I feel it's intriguing and worth exploring as well.
Sure. And those debates and discussions have been ongoing here in the United States as well for 50, 60 years of what is the source? What is oral history? Is it a method, or is it the primary source itself? And there's always these definitions of who's in the umbrella of oral history, and no, you do something else that's different. So it's interesting. I'm sure as the field grows, you'll encounter many of those debates that have been ongoing here as well. So in what ways does oral history intersect with public history in China? It sounds like it is a very public, popular practice rather than one that's just isolated to the archive or academia.
So to actually better discuss the disconnection between oral history and public history, I would like to just talk a little bit more about how public history works in China. Mm-hmm. So that our audience and our readers will have a better idea of who we are. So around the turn of the 21st century, we have a diverse range of public histories emerged across the country. We see, as I mentioned earlier, oral history, of course, goes public. And we also see the ordinary people, they are passionately build their family trees, they trace their technologies. So previously for Chinese, a very strictly personal and private and intimate stories and memoirs, diaries, and family ephemera, they have become available and then become public. So public history in China has taken a populist turn. And we have people who are constantly reenacting performed history in a diverse setting, such as living history, ritual reenactment, documentary films, and also the parade and pageantry and all of that. And we also have the history aficionados playing historic video games and, you know, and of course, a huge number of user-generated histories on the new digital media platforms, including the digital history, visual history, online commemorations, and citizen walking maps. So just a handful of such activities have grown out of the established field of history. Mm. So including family history, genealogy, and oral history probably is still remain the fringe, you know. But an overwhelming majority, however, they're not really attached to any discipline. So the past is enormous popular in China. And with this, to respond to this, the Chinese Academy, actually, the scholars responded to slowly and rather reluctantly. So as a discipline, public history in China has evolved since around the turn of the 21st century. We do have a scatter of the articles introducing how public history works in the United States back in the 1970s. In Chinese literature, they appeared in the 1980s, but it's more like introductory and informational. But it was really in the last decade we started to see a rapid development in public history courses, programs, journals, academic conferences, training programs. So even with that, you know, the past is repeatedly and created, interviewed, reenacted, performed, and narrated. And, you know, even the most conservative academics and historians can't really say that history is working the same way as it always does in the last 3,000 years. Mm-hmm. So here we're not just talking about the cosmetic change of public participation. We're talking about the entire shift of history making, because never in Chinese history has there been so many reasonably educated individuals collectively equipped with such an incredible range of information and ideas thanks to the media technology. Mm-hmm. And never in Chinese history have there been so many people spend so much their time and energy and money and resources exploring the past at such a scale. So you see the traditional balance between the production and the consumption of the history, it's tilted. So the growing public is actually pursuing history. And if there's one single agency that transformed the whole landscape, it's media technology. Mm. It's an expansion of the internet and the way people access historic materials And also, they just change the speed and skills that ordinary Chinese people, they access information in general. So this, you see the balance, you know, between production and consumption of historic knowledge has totally changed. It is in this technological shift or revolution rather that oral history finds a home in public history prior to the digital turn in oral history. When historians work with the analog media, mm-hmm. the traditional presentation, the mode of presentation is, transcripts and also right. the videotapes, and nobody would even care to listen or whatever. It's not accessible to the public. So we see the oral history in the context of public history is primarily technological driven. So that's why I'm very, very excited that see the digital media actually make it possible to return some of the charm and power of oral history, say the voice, the spoken words, back to oral history now, instead of just reading the transcripts and, you know, much less a lot of transcripts aren't even inaccessible to the public. So right. that's we say, you know, actually in the last 6 years, we did three national public history faculty training programs in three different cities in China. And so oral history is always part of the public history training. Even last July, we hosted the third national training programs in Hangzhou. And the theme is public history, oral history, and digital humanities. Mm. So you see this kind of connection, and I think it's organic because it's all has something to do with the media technology. Because unlike the States, back in the 1970s, public history is partly was born for the job crisis. It's not all of that, but partly to resolve that kind of crisis. Whereas in China today, it was born and evolved in the last 20 years. It's primarily technological driven. So that's why oral history and public history are so intricately connected. You just can't really differentiate them sometimes. It's always one or the other. We have a lot of collaborations going on.
That's really interesting. Yeah, they have different roots. That's makes sense that they are so intertwined at this point. So you talked in your article about one type of oral history project being those that deal with, quote, large-scale traumatic events that are part of China's history. How do you think, I'm sure our listeners were really curious about this, we're having ongoing debates here in North America about whether we should be interviewing about COVID-19 right now, or whether we need to slow down and take a breath and wait rather than start collecting interviews in the midst of the crisis, have some time to reflect afterwards. So this is an ongoing discussion among oral history practitioners that's ongoing right now. So I'm wondering if similar debates are playing out in China, for one, and how you see practitioners documenting this recent and current and ongoing tragedy of the coronavirus in China today.
Yes, as I said in the article, one type of oral history projects at a national scale is we document this kind of natural human-made disaster. Mm-hmm. I think it's not only unique to China, it's everywhere. Like our consciousness is defined by the national narratives and in various capacities. So if we think about this kind of disasters at a national scale, and I see, you know, like a state, like in China, we have a very strange attitude. I mean, it's very supportive because it's something, you know, the government really want to want the whole world to see, you know. So for example, the oral history of Nanking massacre and the oral history of the air bombing of Chongqing during the Second World War and also the Wenchuan earthquake, something like that. And so I did also mention the Cultural Revolution, and you know, it's a disaster in a lot of sense, but you know, for the political reasons, and it's still, like, you know, inaccessible, but you know, people are still doing the oral history in that regard. So mostly those oral histories in this category, they are, as I said, reactive, informational, and archival. And so it depends on how much support you get from the national and local support. So we're actually doing that. So in terms of COVID, first, when I was writing an article, there was no COVID-19. And right. So you see the pandemic, it's very, the scale and an impact on the old, on Chinese and even contemporary life or history in retrospect would be very different. So I did mention also a little bit about the medical professionals and how
that's
they
right.
start to collect, you know, some near-death experience from the local hospitals, but they're doing that mostly voluntary without funding. So this type of collections are, you know, they're doing that very grassroots, no funding, and poorly documented, and, you know, much less used. So you see, the COVID-19 is very different, you know, so we don't have an aftermath yet. Usually oral history is done, you know, after the whole thing, you know, is gone, and, you know, you do have that distant issue. But, you know, with COVID, it's still ongoing. So that's why, you know, when back in February, when Dr. Li Wenliang, the whistleblowers, you know, died a new coronavirus, there was an instant online memorial commemorations via social media platform, probably, you know, as WeChat or Facebook, the Chinese version of Facebook, all over the world, you know. You see the emotion was high and the void was there. The people sent posts and the audio and visual materials just online, just to, you know, you see it in real time. And there's a connection back to the oral history I talk about. The connect with the collective inner sense of psychology of that particular moment. And people may say, oh, this kind of stories, they lack the reflective and then sustaining quality, and they're not even oral history, but you see the need is there. So this actually gives me sort of like two lessons for oral historians in China, is that, you know, we have the, you know, we have the responsibility of doing something at this particular moment instead of just collecting the stories. So so basically, getting back to your question, I think Chinese historians and scholars at this point, we have to kind of conscious to really respond, you know, to the COVID. And, you know, in China, we're at another cycle because the government just eased some restrictions and, you know, so people can go out. So whereas in the last 3 months, 2 to 3 months, they are quarantined in a very limited space, but most of the people, they are perfectly healthy. So I ask students, I mean, not only me, but a group of university professors, they ask their students either do a audio biography of their time quarantine period, or they start to compare life before and after the quarantine. Now they actually can do some photo voice projects. They have their phones and they can walk in the street to see how they open up, you know, the landscapes, and then their interpretation of the urban space is very different when they are quarantined in the limited space. And now they can go out to the open space or public space and doing some interpretation. And they still kind of limited, you know, with a little psychological fear, you know, because you still need to keep the social distancing and wear masks and all of that. So yeah, so we're kind of doing that. And, you know, so we are actually starting up a sort of a national scale. It's a large scale public oral history projects about collecting and curating and archiving the history and the memory of COVID-19 pandemic. in China. It's we just started, and you know, so we did some sort of like initial investigation and applying some grants, you know, and so we're imagining sort of like three steps. The first is you try to do some crowdsourcing. So let me get back a little bit. So this project is and try to address some of the challenges I mentioned in an article. Instead of just collecting the random data, we want to make it usable. And we try to establish sort of a database, oral history database, so people, not only in China, but globally, they can access that, you know. So with that in mind, so we designed this in these three stages. The first is you try to crowdsourcing. So we're actually talking with Professor Michael Frisch in Buffalo. Story. So we're working on the Chinese version of that, you know, to see, you know, if it's because it, with this kind of a short video and a photo voices, you know, so people can generate some kind of introduction and also interpretation, and it's short. So, you know, it's extremely useful for this kind of large scale participatory, you know, oral history project. The point of doing this is, you know, boils down to asking the right question. So initially, when we're doing oral history, we try to design the questions from our perspectives, right? So you go out and handing, you know, or mentally remember this question, ask questions, go into the field to find, to confirm what you are looking for. Whereas this time, we try to crowdsource, you know, some photo prompt to voice response about the convict. And with that, the second step, we try to design the intensive and structured interviews. And, you know, we're working with a different universities across China, and we try to make it like collaborative projects. So the third step, we try to build a sort of a national memory bank. And so with the index and searchable oral history database. So this is, you know, we try to address some of the challenges in those three steps instead of, you know, so for example, we were planning our history training workshop so that people, you know, sort of like, especially when you interview survivors or the frontline workers, you know, how are you going to resolve that distant issue? One of the students, one of my students whose parents are both working in Wuhan as a frontline workers, and, you know, so their experience is very different from those who are quarantined at our apartment. So those kind of things, and students are really uncomfortable with the distance, with the silence, you know, because they try to keep asking questions. I think all of that, you need certain training in how to deal with the narrators and the interviewers, the distance, and the techniques and skills of doing oral history, especially in the COVID-19 project. It's not an easy question to ask. And also right now we're doing the distance interview, so oral history at a distance. And by the way, I really appreciate, you know, the OHR did that, you know, put that free workshop online, so we take advantage of that. And so right now we're doing some oral history at a distance, but one thing is that, you know, if you interview people on such an emotionally intense subject, and working in at a distance sometimes make it impersonal, you know, just like telling people their loved ones are dying on the phone, you know, it's you know, so we try to, you know, we're struggling with this kind of issues, how to, you know, and treat our narrators as you know, with humanity, just not just the subjects, you know, providing information for us. So you see, we're struggling with this kind of, you know, emotional and academic issues in this project, but we're just starting up. I'm very excited about this, you know, project. We call it a public oral history project at such a scale. As I said, we're applying the National Social Science Fund funds, you know, later this year. And so, but we can't wait till we have money to do this, because it's ongoing, as you said, and it's all over. So yeah, so it's exciting.
Well, I'm glad you've been able to, yeah, spend some time doing project design in addition to everything else. It is important to be thoughtful and deliberate about how you're going to approach, especially a topic like this, for sure. So your article talks some about this, and you already mentioned this, the challenges of what the traditional dominant historical narratives are and how oral history has been able to challenge those narratives, whether they're controversial subjects or, quote, factual knowledge that differs when you hear it at the grassroots level. So how have you been able to, with controversial subjects in the past, whether it's the Cultural Revolution or any other sort of taboo subject, how has oral history been able to approach those difficult topics in a new way?
Hard. Okay. Yeah. But we're working on it. So one thing I usually preach what I'm doing, and you know, I tell my students that, you know, when we have been doing oral history, it's go beyond the factual information, and you're not afraid of taking on controversial subjects. You take a stance, and you use your techniques and skills and knowledge and try to defend what you're doing. So try not to avoid the difficult issues. On the other hand, I have to protect them in a lot of ways. So I think one of the things of working about the oral history and public history in China in general, those kind of projects, is that I don't really use words like unlawful or you know, I mean, I usually say it's a different interpretations of a certain sensitive historic subjects, you know. So at a minimal level, say for example, the Cultural Revolution, and even before I went back to China, I see people are doing some oral histories, and they just archives, you know, and they know the people who experienced the Cultural Revolution. They they're at zero age, probably is the right time to do oral history, and they're gone, their history is gone, that kind of thing. And you know, the problem is that that kind of oral history does not really go into public because it's archived, you know. When will it go into public? We don't know. But you know, I appreciate this kind of political savvy. I always joke that you work with the system instead of against the system, you mm-hmm. know. And actually that's the charm of doing oral history, is that you know you dig out some surprising stuff, and you know you present that in a tactful way. For example, last back 2 years ago, I worked on this museum project, Jackson. You know, we try to use oral history and to document one of the cities, evolution of one of the cities in for their exhibits. So we actually touch upon the very sensitive subject about demolition and preservation. And so I mean, we instead of just saying this right or wrong, and we try to use the photographs and doing some very strategic, you know, manipulation about, you know, like how we're going to describe that, use the different words, and you know, so that's something you leave the audience with some kind of, you know, genuine, you know, room for discussions, and they know there's another aspects out there. Maybe it's not really openly stated, but it's there. So that's something I see, it's a beauty of doing oral history. And you know, so at the minimal level, we're archiving something. And I know even with the COVID, and you know, I think there are some controversial, you know, political issues about the origin, about, you know, how people treat, you know, the different voices and their attitude towards the quarantine. But you know, like that's why we're doing this, you know. Otherwise, you know, there's no point of just to confirm what we've already known, right? So so it's interesting dynamics going on. So I know we, as I said, you know, we're all defined by national narratives. It's just in different capacities, right? So, or if oral history has some sense, you know, can challenge the some version of a history, and I think that's at least we're presenting the different perspectives, you know, and so that people leave people to think about and to explore at their own pace. I think that's the kind of, you know, and you know, the goals that we're trying to reach in terms of doing oral history on sensitive and sometimes controversial subjects.
Right. I want to close by asking you to reflect a bit on, we published about a year ago, Alexander Freund's piece, Long Shadows Over New Beginnings, Oral History in Contemporary China. And Freund is a Canadian scholar who came and visited China. I'm sure you're familiar with his work. And I was just curious how you see your perspective in relationship to his. He studied oral history in contemporary China from an outsider's perspective, where you're here in the thick of it. You're writing the grants and directing projects and analyzing what's going on from your perspective. What do you see as a difference in his outsider's vantage point compared to yours?
So Professor Freund's article, The Long Shadows of New Beginnings, it's a very fine piece. And I actually agree with him a lot, you know, of what he said in the articles. For example, he said our history in China is not just an academic activity, but even more so a popular culture and social activities, and, you know, which that can be deeply political. And that's definitely right. As you said, you know, as an outsider, he has certain vantage point, you know, I've actually learned a lot from this article. So my piece is a little focused on a little bit different, you know, aspects of oral history. So it's a different focus. And if you notice that we use a different languages. So for example, Professor Freund, and his article is very, because he's an expertise in Chinese history, and, you know, with his recent experience of visiting China. And so he used a lot of Western scholarships, you know, back, or the Chinese scholars, work published in English language. So this is a very vigorous theoretical and academic approach. But the language is a little bit different, you know. So for example, in the article, I noticed that there is a social discipline and a tool of mass control and enforced public confession, which are all right. And it's legitimate. But, you know, my focus is rather the public aspects of oral history. And so actually, for now, there's simply very limited academic literature on the public aspects of oral history, even in Chinese language, much less in English language. So I think the way that I survey the landscape, you know, with a very different focus, because I don't really, you know, drop them from the current literature and doing like theoretical reflections and, you know, give people a genealogy, something like that. I try to focus on the public aspects. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to mention this insider and outsider perspectives. My first major work was analyzing the one of the historic districts in Canada, in Toronto. So with that project, I actually transferred from a outsider who were, you know, raised in China, educated in the States, and working the project in Canada without speaking Hebrew. It's a Jewish market. So, and ended up with this project, I ended up immigrating to Canada and, you know, started to be part of that neighborhood. And I see how interesting my interpretation of Kensington Market, you know, the neighborhood has changed with my identity. You know, so the way I talk to people there, starting from like a much like an outsider, could you talk a little bit about this? Instead, then I can use more story and narratives and that kind of thing. So this, when I analyze now the public aspect of oral history in China, I you know, I read the literature, I read the transcripts and I listen to the recordings, and I sense, you know, not only my Chinese language helps in differentiate the sort of scholarly oral history project and also the public oral history projects, but I started to see more dynamics, you know, really, you know, from the grassroots, and that excites me. When I was writing this article, and I see, you know, there's a lot, you know, I can explore more. For example, we work on the history and memory of Hangzhou, and, you know, you when the local residents started to tell their stories, and you use your own language, local language, and mm-hmm. I started to think, hey, we should document that, we should work with them, you know, on this, it's community level, it's grassroots, this is exactly how oral history, you know, is so powerful, yeah, just to bring those community stories out there, and, you know, in the public domain, and this gets back to what oral history is really for. So yeah, if you ask me the difference, and I think that that perspective, interesting, the change of perspectives from outsider and insider, and also the identity issue. And, you know, because we talk about, you know, how you're gonna share the authority and oral histories. I definitely feel, you know, the working on this article and working on the aspects of oral history helps me be a better listener, you know, like I, you know, so, and listen to their local voices, and, you know, see how they contribute the larger part of the history making in China.
Well, that's what I really took away as such an important contribution from your article, is this seeing it from the public's perspective and hearing just what a huge impact it has on popular consciousness throughout China. I found it really enlightening to read about. I spent a semester in China when I was in college many years ago, and so it was really helpful thinking about, you know, what I understood from Chinese culture in Sichuan, you know, 25 years ago, and like kind of imagining how the world has changed so much, and how, what a great impact a practice like oral history can have on a culture and a people's consciousness. So thank you so much for that contribution. Again, Lina's article is History, Memory, and Identity, Oral History in China, and I highly recommend it. In our most recent issue, 47.1, you can find it online, and the hard copy should have arrived in your mailboxes a few weeks ago as well. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. It's really been a delight.
It's my pleasure, Jonathan. Thank you very much.